Tēnā koutou no mai, haere mai. Welcome to Q&A. I'm Jack Tame. This morning, the man who would be Palestine's ambassador to New Zealand with a plea to our government.
I think New Zealand as a respectful and credible country within the international community could have the lead.
Then, as Winston Peters and Bob Carr trade insults and legal threats, we get the case for joining AUKUS.
And stability requires not just engagement with Beijing, but also deterrence.
We'll have that interview for you shortly. As we go to air this morning, negotiators for Israel and Hamas are meeting to discuss terms for a ceasefire in Gaza, with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu still threatening to invade Rafah, where most of Gaza's population is sheltering. On Q&A, we're committed to bringing you a range of voices and perspectives on what we know is an incredibly sensitive and contentious issue. There is no Palestinian representative who's a direct equivalent to Israel's ambassador. But Izzat Salah Abdul Hadi is a representative of the Palestinian Authority, who heads the General Delegation of Palestine to New Zealand. Now, it's important to note, the Palestinian Authority governs the West Bank and is an entirely different entity to Hamas, which governs Gaza. He returned from the Middle East this week, and we sat down together yesterday at his embassy in Canberra. You have just returned from the occupied West Bank. 7 months in, how are Palestinians there feeling about the conflict?
The Palestinians in Gaza and West Bank and even in diaspora are angry and sad because what's happening, devastating situation in Gaza. It was unprecedented, genocidal, brutal attack on onslaught by Israelis on Gaza people. I mean, the mass loss of humans, more than now 34,600, killed by the Israelis, murdered by the Israelis, actually. I mean, you know that the families destroy. I mean, the medical centers all destroyed. 31 of 38 of hospitals are out of work now, unfortunately. And of course, we are, reaching famine and starvation in Gaza. So the situation is very bad, not only in Gaza, but in the West Bank. As you mentioned, I was in West Bank very recently, in Nablus, Ramallah, and other cities, and I can see the feeling of the Palestinian people. They are angry, and they can see the double standard of the Western country, unfortunately, how they deal with Ukraine, Russia, as an example in double standard. They don't believe of this self-defense process by Israelis. And also, they can see the failure of international community to create a hope for the Palestinian people or horizon, for peace and justice. Justice is the most important thing for Palestinian people. If I want to talk about historical context and, the political context, 80% of the Palestinian people in Gaza are refugees, actually. They were expelled from their own hometowns and their cities in 1948. Their own cities is just 40 kilometers from Gaza. And Gaza was under a brutal, siege for 17 years, which created unemployment, poverty, despair. Of the Palestinian in Gaza. From ethnic cleansing in 1948, the failure of international community to deal with the refugee issues, 800,000 Palestinians were expelled from their own homeland in 1948. 500 villages were destroyed totally. And, refugees dispersed to the neighboring country. Until the present, the international community failed to solve the problem, right to return of the Palestinian people to their own homeland, based on the United Nations Resolution 194 in 1947, which includes the right to return or and compensation. And then we have the apartheid system, illegal occupation 1967, and establishment of an Israeli apartheid system in Palestine, and then the brutal siege and now genocide. It's a very sad story of the Palestinian people.
What was life like for Palestinians in Gaza in the West Bank before October 7?
Yeah, it's as I mentioned before, we're subjected, to apartheid system. In the West Bank, as an example, the Israeli colonial settler colonial project enterprise increased 800,000 settlers. Living now in West Bank, East Jerusalem. And this is a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which you can move people from the occupied power to the occupiers to the occupied. And of course, they control more than 40% now of the only 22% of historic Palestine already. And of course, there are a lot of attacks terrible horror, you know, attacks of settlers, of the Palestinian people, pass-by roads, discrimination against the Palestinian people in West Bank. In Gaza, it was also terrible, devastating, because of the siege, as I mentioned, 17 years of brutal siege on Gaza. And the life was also terrible, devastating, difficult for the people in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Young generation can't find jobs. Poverty rates reach more than 50% in Gaza. Unemployment is more than 40%. And no access, I mean, to abroad or overseas. Education, they don't have sufficient supplies, water supplies, petrol, you know, electricity. It's four hours electricity per day. And of course, because Israel controls the crossings, so the supplies, equipment to Gaza was very limited. Mm. So it becomes more brutal now after 7th of October, but I think the life of Palestinians was all the time difficult under brutal Israeli occupation.
In your position, you are concerned with the progress of Palestinian statehood, but I think it would be valuable for our audience just to establish some really basic points. Does Israel also have the right to exist?
Mm-hmm. Look, in 1993, our later Yasser Arafat recognized the right of Israel to exist. This is a public statement, beginning of Oslo. So we recognized, I mean, the right of Israel to exist. Unfortunately, at that time, Israel did not recognize the self-determination of Palestinian people as a state. They recognized that PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, is the sole representative of the Palestinian people. So historically, Israel denied the self-determination of Palestinian people while the Palestinians recognize the right of Israel.
So to be clear, though, as we stand here in 2024, you recognize the right of Israel to exist?
Yes, this is our own official position, actually. Beginning of Oslo, as I mentioned.
And do you recognize Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state?
Look, this is very controversial because Israel itself does not name itself as Jewish. We support the United Nations titling of Israel, that it's a state of Israel. So if we talk about Jewish state, this means to undermine the rights of more than 21% of the Israeli citizens, who's the Palestinian community now in Israel. So why we should have a religious country? I mean, Pakistan, as example, is criticized because it's called Islamic Pakistan. So we can't, if in the future, whatever, Israel in its constitution, whatever, title itself, whatever, we'll see. But actually, for the time being, we have a huge Palestinian community. It's a good portion. I mean, it's 2 million Palestinians now in Israel. So it will be discriminating against the rights of the Palestinian community in Israel.
To recognize it as a Jewish state,
yes.
To be totally clear, you are not a representative of Hamas. You're a representative of the Palestinian Authority, the ruling party for which, Fatah, has explicitly opposed Hamas. But I want to talk about October 7th.
I'm representing the Palestinian people. I'm representing the Palestinian state and Palestinian Liberation Organization.
From your perspective, was October 7th terrorism or a legitimate act of war?
For us, killing civilians from both sides is not acceptable. It's a violation of international law. Having said that, I explained clearly the historical and political context. You can't just, talk about 7th of October in a political vacuum. You need all the time to provide more information and analysis of what's happening in 7th of October. Otherwise, it will be just as if 7th of October is the starting of the conflict, Israeli-Palestine conflict. And I explained this from 1948, illegal occupation and brutal siege on Gaza.
You have provided us with that context from your perspective. But,
yes.
But to be clear, do those attacks on October 7th, specifically the ones that targeted civilians, do they constitute terrorism or, in your view, were they a legitimate act of war?
Look, I think when we talk about terrorism and Hamas as a terrorist organization, our own reference is the United Nations list. Not necessarily that the Western country, if they prescribe any organization as terrorist, it's a terrorist. I think this is a very controversial issue because terrorism in particular discussed internationally in different fora, including United Nations. Look, until the present, as an example, none one resolution from United Nations General Assembly recognized or prescribed Hamas as a terrorist organization. The Palestinian, and this is one aspect of the issue. The second aspect is how the Palestinian perceived Hamas. And I don't think that the Palestinian, majority of Palestinians, describes Hamas as a terrorist organization.
And so in your view, as a representative of the Palestinian people, you do not see those
acts? Our position is Hamas is not a terrorist organization.
Yeah, and that those acts, therefore, were not terrorism.
Sorry?
And that those acts on October 7th were not terrorism.
Look, I think this is also very controversial. Yes, I think whatever you want, I all the time put it in context.
I understand the context. I understand the context.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people who will look at the specific detail of those attacks.
Do you recognize,
attacks?
Like, as an example, Israel as a state terrorist country?
This is not a decision for me to make. I'm not an ambassador.
Right. I mean, this is what I'm saying. It's just. I mean, terrorism, as I mentioned, has different aspects, features, and clarifications. So
you've talked about the context for the attacks. Israel has not occupied the Gaza Strip in the same way it occupies the West Bank today for almost 20 years. And before October 7, a ceasefire of sorts was in place. Mm-hmm. Some Gazans, albeit with significant restrictions, were able to work and travel in Israel or to receive healthcare in Israel. Do you accept that Israel's ongoing attacks in Gaza would not be happening if not for October 7?
Look, I think, first of all, I mean, Israel does not leave Gaza in 2005. This was redeployment of its forces because then they imposed a very strict siege on Gaza Strip. And those Gazans people don't have access to outside. So, and they also unilaterally left Gaza without any coordination process with Palestinian Authority. And if you have handover plan, you need, of course, to have a handover plan. You need, I mean, to coordinate this with the Palestinian Authority and with other stakeholders like the, you know, World Bank, as an example, has a plan at that time, has not been implemented. So they just redeployed their own forces, first of all. Second, I mean, if you go to the West Bank, Gaza Strip, whatever, because we don't have access to outside and Israeli controlling all our own crossings, sometimes we need, I mean, to have, like, transfer patients to Israeli hospitals, and this is not free of charge. We pay for this. Mm-hmm. And usually it's a very difficult process, especially for the people in Gaza. As an example, all the time they restricted any a companion of a patient to go to the hospitals and in certain, you know, illnesses. So I think it wasn't like what described by Israel, that they facilitated the life of Gaza.
I accept that there were really significant restrictions in place.
Yes, very
from the Israeli side on residents in Gaza. But to my question, do you accept that the ongoing incursion in Gaza would not be happening from Israel if not for the events of October 7?
It's just, I mean, to remind you that about 5 onslaught attacks by Israel on Gaza for the last 15 years, for the last 16 years, actually. So it's all the time there was a problem between Israel and Gaza.
Right. So that doesn't still answer my question, though.
Yeah, I don't think that in this large scale it could happen. Yes, I agree.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but I agree that it won't happen that in this scale if we don't have 7th of October.
Just Israel would argue, it will say that the reason that it exerts so much control over Gaza is that the Strip was governed by a group that is explicitly committed to the destruction of the state of Israel. And the blockade was in place effectively to stop Hamas from militarizing. What is the alternative from Israel's perspective? Should they just leave Hamas to militarize as they wish?
Let me clarify first that also a significant portion of Israeli politicians are also aiming to prevent any self-determination for the Palestinian people and also to destroy this ambitious ambition by the Palestinian people to have their own state in 22%. For the last 30 years, we failed, I mean, to achieve any outcome of the Oslo process by establishing a Palestinian state. For Hamas, as an example, In 2017, there was a significant change in their own charter, which includes the recognition of a Palestinian state in 1967. And I'm sure that you are watching also the news and also the spokespersons of Hamas these days, in which they confirm their all support also to a Palestinian state in 1967. Also, Hamas in 2017 said that they are their own main focus on Palestine, so they are not an organic part of the Brotherhood movement internationally.
So, again, I just want to acknowledge that you're not a spokesperson for Hamas.
No,
very important for our viewers to understand.
Yes.
But the original Hamas charter was explicit.
And not necessarily I agree on their own policy.
No, that's fine, and you can explain that point. The original Hamas charter quoted the hadith that the hour of judgment shall not come until the Muslims fight the Jews and kill them. There is no solution for the Palestinian question except through jihad was also a line in that original charter. I mean, Hamas is explicit about their desire to destroy the Israeli state. So from Israel's perspective, how should they have approached the Gaza situation? If Gaza is governed by Hamas, which is committed to Israel's destruction, how could they not exercise a blockade to try and control the militarization of Hamas?
But look, I explained that now Hamas, a charter is different, talking about Palestinian state 1967. But I agree, I mean, it's just in their charter, they're talking about, Israel, Palestine is Islamic Waqf. Don't forget the historical context again, because Palestine was colonized by Israelis in the 30s, white immigrants coming to Palestine, and the British mandate facilitated the establishment of Palestinian state, of the Israel state. So we should all the time remember this context. I don't agree with Hamas now, I mean, whatever, of their own vision towards the two-state solution as an example, not recognition of Israel. I hope that if Hamas support the PLO program as an example in 1988, which includes the establishment of Palestinian state 1967 borders with the right to return of the Palestinian refugees. Through all our own discussion with Hamas for the last 15 years to reach a unity between Hamas and Fatah and Palestinian Authority and Hamas, we stressed all the time our own vision of two-state solution, including a Palestinian state coexist peacefully with Israel, and also try to convince Hamas of our own strategy of non-violent strategy, internationalization, unity, and steadfastness of our Palestinian people by establishing vibrant institutions.
I suppose that hasn't necessarily worked, though, has it? Because obviously Hamas led those October 7th attacks.
Right.
I'll ask you about the relationship between Fatah and Hamas in a little bit, because I think it's really critical when we're thinking about the future of a potential Palestinian state. After the break on Q&A, with huge protests around the world in support of the Palestinian cause, we ask if violence has worked to effect change. Hawkey Meyer, welcome back. The Hamas attack on October 7th included extreme acts of violence against Israeli civilians, including widespread reports of sexual violence. But in the months since, as international condemnation of Israel's military response has intensified, several countries have moved to officially recognise a Palestinian state. In the second part of our interview, I asked Izzat Salah Abdul Hadi if the renewed prominence of Palestinian self-determination demonstrates that despite the awful human toll, ultimately, violence has worked.
Look, I don't think violent. This is supporting the international law and the people in Gaza, not necessarily supporting Hamas or supporting violence. Because people understand that power, naked power creates legitimacy in certain occasions, whatever. But actually, our own strategy and also the diaspora strategy, I think, is peaceful solution to Israel-Palestine conflict using nonviolent resistance.
Nonetheless, the cause for Palestinian statehood has arguably been progressed significantly in the last 7 months, at least compared to the period immediately before it. So can you see that in the eyes of some people, violence has been an effective measure of, at the very least, getting this wider issue back in the world's attention?
This is not necessarily because 7th October or violence. This is because of resilience of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And because of this one episode of our own resilience, steadfastness and resistance of the Israelis. So it's very sensitive issue, because not one slogan or any banner of the rallies talks about supporting Hamas or violence. They talk about justice for Palestinian people, and also talk about just peace for the Palestinian people.
But I suppose we didn't see these protests before October 7th, is my point.
It's more nothing on the scale that we've seen now. To the scale of what happened in Gaza. Of course, it depends on what's happening in Gaza.
I mean, even seeing, for example, New Zealand's Labour Party saying that Palestine should be recognised as a state. I mean, they weren't saying that 8 months ago.
Yeah, look, what's happening now in the international community, including New Zealand, is changing the approach towards self-determination and recognition of the state of Palestine. The traditional classical position of Western country towards self-determination of Palestinian people and the establishment of a Palestinian state was through bilateral negotiations between Israel and Palestine, through Oslo agreement. Now it's different, because now they're talking about, let's recognize state of Palestine first, let's recognize state of Palestine outside, not necessarily have the approval of Israel, especially after the statement of Netanyahu saying that he will not support self-determination or state under his watch. So this is now, and finally, status issue should be discussed later. So the approach is different. And this is based, again, on the understanding of the international community that they will not all the time reconstruct Gaza after 5 years, after five wars on Gaza, and they start to realize that there should be a sort of horizon, you know, peace horizon in the region.
I will ask again about the future of Palestinian statehood in a couple of minutes, but it goes back to that original point. I suppose none of these conversations had the prominence before October 7, and there are some people who would say that in this instance, violence has been shown to be an effective measure of, at the very least, getting some of these broader issues back into the global spotlight.
But look, I mean, again, Jack, it's also about the... it was an opportunity for the Palestinian people, Palestinian representative, Palestinian community, also to promote their own story all over the world. And I think this is a very important issue. So it's... And we have a new generation of Palestinians, third generation, fourth generation in, you know, outside Palestine and also in Gaza and West Bank, who also know more about what's happening. And they start to organize themselves differently. And this is a very peaceful process in which they will be a part of a global agenda advocating for equality and justice.
How should Israel have responded to October 7?
I'm not a representative of Israel. I don't know how they will respond to this. But what I can say that Israel does not have the right to self-defense, because Gaza is not a state by itself. This is according to Security Council Resolution 1840 in 2009.
They don't have the right to self-defense.
No, they don't have right to self-defense. They have the right of what what is implemented or should be implemented. The law of occupation, which is the main objective of this law, is to protect the civilians, people. The occupier power does not have self-defense. This is according to the advisory opinion in 2004 by ICJ.
So you're saying that Israel should not have responded with violent means to that attack?
I think this scale is not is unprecedented, and I don't know what will be.
A smaller incursion might have been appropriate?
I don't know. I mean, I think that they should not do this at all. It's just, I mean, try to find another way, but not to destroy Gaza. What's happening now is they are killing Palestinians, destroying Gaza, and not targeting Hamas. I'm not a military expert to see how they can respond, whatever, to this. But I think, for me, international law should be in all times implemented.
I want to ask about morality, because it seems to me that at the centre of this conflict is a question of morality. From a moral perspective, you question the legality of it. Israel argues a moral responsibility to defend its citizens. On the Palestinian side, some would argue that it is morally acceptable for those who believe they are oppressed to resist with any means necessary. But when considering individual actions from October 7th forth, people on both sides of this conflict have inflicted terrible violence affecting each other's civilian populations. How do you morally distinguish between Israel and Hamas's actions?
Look, I think this is not a fair equation because, I mean, as I mentioned in historical context, that we are the victims, we are occupied, we are, I mean, subjected to discrimination, colonization, and suppression. And if you say that this is two states equal and Israel have the right to respond and to self-defense, whatever, this is wrong. Our own resistance as occupied people is recognized by international law, even armed struggle, actually. You can go to the, I mean, a Charter of United Nations and also the United Nations resolution in which recognized armed struggle against occupation. And we should not forget at any minute that we are under Israeli occupation and we have the right to resist. The type of resistance, violent, non-violence, depends on the circumstances, balance of power, and the political context at this moment. Mm-hmm. For us as Palestinians now, we thought that non-violent resistance is more effective in this time.
But are you saying that violent resistance is morally justifiable from the Palestinian side because you believe you are an
against military
people?
Occupation, yes, by international law.
What about against civilian populations?
No, I'm against because my terms of reference all the time, our terms of reference is international law, international humanitarian law. So we're against killing civilians right. From both sides.
So let me ask about international law. The genocide case brought against Israel by South Africa is pending at the moment at the ICJ. In January, the judges considering the case stopped short of ordering Israel to stop fighting immediately, but overwhelmingly voted to remind Israel of its obligations to prevent genocide. Mm-hmm. Whether they have upheld those obligations in the time since under the Genocide Convention is a significant point of contention. What's your view?
Look, I mean, provisional measures by ICJ was very clear. As you mentioned, you know, they will, I mean, give Israel 1 month monitoring system and see if they are continue their own massacres, collective punishment and the violation of human rights and international law and continue their own genocidal brutal. I think this is what's happening now. And although it's not that large scale in the media now, but every day they killed more like 50 civilians and individuals in Gaza. So we should wait, I mean, for this evaluation assessment of the ICJ. But I was impressed by a lot of lawyers who confirmed that what's happening in Gaza now is genocide.
Hamas cannot be tried for genocide because Palestine does not have statehood as such. Do you believe that Hamas's actions on October 7th would also constitute genocide?
Yeah, I mean, this is what the ICC and ICJ, I mean, also suggested. So Hamas themselves said that they are happy, I mean, are willing, I mean, to be present in front of any court, ICC, in this context. So I think this is across-the-board process, and the implementation of international law should not be selective.
So my question, though, is do you believe Hamas's actions on October 7th constitute genocide?
I don't think, because we don't have any now description of this as genocide. It's described as terrorist, it's attack, whatever. But nobody now talks about genocide, you know, Hamas genocide.
Deliberate targeting of civilian populations.
Yeah, but
obviously.
This is violation maybe of international law, as I mentioned.
You don't believe civilians. It's genocide?
No, I don't believe it's genocide, because I don't think the intent is there, and they are not a state, and it's a different case from the Israeli.
But if they could be tried, as a state would be, under the Genocide Convention, you don't believe that Hamas's actions would constitute genocide? That's
I don't think
point.
They're constantly on genocide now.
After the break on Q&A. As Labor urges the government to formally recognise a Palestinian state, we ask what New Zealand's role should be when it comes to peace in the Middle East. Labor's Foreign Affairs spokesperson David Parker has written to the government and asked it to formally recognise a Palestinian state and suggested Izzat Salah Abdul Hadi should be invited to present his credentials as ambassador. For the final part of our interview, I asked if Palestine does achieve statehood, who will lead it? The PA, Fatah or Hamas? In 2006, after Israel left Gaza, at least in the same way they had occupied Gaza previously, Hamas and Fatah clashed in a brutal civil war. Hundreds of Palestinians were killed. If Palestine achieved statehood today, why would it be any different?
As I mentioned before, Hamas support now the establishment of Palestinian state 1967 borders, and through a lot of discussion and meetings between Fatah and Hamas, I mean, we'll try, to, or both of them try, I mean, to find a solution in which Hamas should support the vision of the Palestinian Authority, which is the implementation of the two-state solution, and also to agree on non-violent strategy. So still the discussion is there. I'm not sure what will be the outcome of this war, what will happen to Hamas, how they will change their own views. I can see slight of changes, you know, of their own. But if we have a Palestinian state self-determination, I don't think that there will be the same old paradigm in which fighting between Hamas and Fatah. Because if Hamas becoming a political party, as an example, and agree again on our own division of the Palestinian state and strategy, and also respond to the quartet, you know, prerequisites, the international community requisites, to recognize Hamas and to be a part of the PLO and the structure governance of Palestinian Authority, then maybe we will have a sort of support to the Palestinian state. Look, I mean, both Hamas and Fatah agreed to conduct elections. I think we need to return back to the Palestinian people. Palestinian people will decide who will be their own rulers, leadership, and governance. This is very important because I noticed from the Western country also, international community, that they want to decide on behalf of the Palestinian people what will be their own governance, either in Gaza or West Bank or Gaza and West Bank. So I think a democratic election is the best tool, instrument, actually, to decide what will be the future of the Palestinian state.
And what would it mean if Hamas were to win that election? Hamas, that as an organization is still committed to the destruction of Israel?
They should be a responsible party. What happened in 2006? They won the elections, and there was sanctions from international community, and Fatah won the presidency at that time, and there were mechanisms to deal with international community, especially supporting the institutional...
It was a civil war of sorts.
Yeah. No, it was, that's right, it's happening there.
In 2006.
But I think now it will be different a little bit. I mean, it's just people are really supporting, you know, democracy in different ways.
The Palestinian Authority hasn't held elections in many years. There are many Palestinians, including those in New Zealand, who say that you, Fatah, the PA, help to prop up Israel and don't properly represent their interests. So what is your message to those people?
Look, we have two different legitimacy. You know, we have also the legitimacy of representing PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, and also, of course, the legitimacy of Palestinian Authority through elections. We should ask about who was behind this delay of elections. Last time, in last year, the president announced the date for elections. We have like 18 lists to run the elections, and unfortunately, out of sudden, Israel said that no elections in East Jerusalem. We can't actually hold elections without East Jerusalem. This is a very important thing. Before that, because of the division between Fatah and Hamas, Hamas did not support elections in Gaza. And of course, this means that the government of Palestine, Palestinian Authority, will not also agree to have elections without Gaza. So there are many reasons that stopped elections in Palestine and the democratic process. But now, I mean, it's just one of the most important tasks of the new government is to prepare for elections.
Well, I guess my question is, if Palestinians outside of the region, the diaspora, can't even unite around a single point for leadership, what hope is there that Palestinians within a new Palestinian state might do
Look,
so?
Look, I don't think that there is a problem in outside Palestine that supports self-determination for Palestinian people. There is a discussion about two states, one state.
I think you're right. Yeah, people agree on self-determination, of course, but it's who should lead that state. Yeah. And in the eyes of many Palestinians, you are not necessarily legitimate. Yeah. And it's hard to see how, if there is so much... dispute or disunity outside of the region, what it might be like inside the region.
I can confirm to you that there is huge support to the Palestinian embassy here from Palestinian community. We have different points of view. We are diverse. They have different views about the Palestinian Authority, representation, the embassy, whatever. But for them, this embassy is the sole and legitimate representation of Palestinian people. representing Palestinian people, not necessarily representing one faction, because as ambassadors, we don't, I mean, represent political parties. We represent the interest of the Palestinian people. I can confirm this to you. I mean, it's just we have differences. We have, you know, discussing things, whatever, one state, two states, you know, status quo, ethnic cleansing, etc. But we are engaged in a robust, bold discussion with the Palestinian community about this.
What have you made of New Zealand's response to the last 7 months?
Look, I mean, we maintain an excellent relation with in New Zealand. I think New Zealand position is different a little bit from other Western countries, has certain relative independence from the United States, very supportive to multilateral system, very supportive to small countries in United Nations. Very recently, the foreign minister said that he is supporting reform of the United Nations, including, I mean, the vetoes for the four permanents. He's against this. And he discussed this with the Secretary General of the United Nations. In New Zealand, as a small country, I can't remember their own approach strategy when they were a permanent member of Security Council, in which, I mean, they have a sort of bold consultation process with small countries in United Nations.
They have condemned settlements, for
condemned
example.
Settlements, yep. And also they support all the time voting for the Palestinian resolution in United. None one time they don't support the resolutions, Palestinian resolution, which talk about self-determination. And of course, for them, settlements are illegal by international law, and support the two-state solution, including the establishment of a Palestinian state.
So Labour has called for Palestine to be recognised with formal diplomatic recognition, for you to be invited to present credentials as ambassador. Mm. Our foreign minister says it's a case of when, not if, but the time is not now.
Yeah. What do you make of that? I think the time is now. I talked this to the foreign minister. I met with him in February, and we had a good discussion about the necessity and importance to save the two-state solution through the recognition of New Zealand of the Palestinian state. Look, there are a lot of discussion about the basis of, you know, the significance of recognition of state of Palestine, especially, I mean, talking how we can recognize state of Palestine without borders, the problem with Hamas, whatever. But recognition of state of Palestine is very strong statement message to Israel to implement, enforce the two-state solution and to identify the borders and final issue Jerusalem refugees based on international law. It's a very strong message supporting international law, not power and naked power, I mean, utilized by Israel. So it's a political issue. It's not necessarily, I mean, talk about legal, moral, whatever, although these are other important factors. So I think in New Zealand, as a respectful and credible country within the international community, could have the lead. Because sometimes leadership means you bear certain risks and do actions which will strengthen your own credibility. And if New Zealand recognizes Palestine, this will be a step towards Australia to recognize Palestine because of the strong ties between the two countries. And this is what I said also to the Australian position, leaders, in which if they recognize the state of Palestine, taking the lead, because they have both credibility in the international arena. So it's very important for also Palestinian people, because although it's a small step, not necessarily well implemented, it provides certain hope to Palestinian people that there is something, there is a hope for them in the future to have their own state, independent state, in which they can live in peace and security. Also, it's just implemented because Palestinians have injustice for a long, long time, from, you know, 1948 until the present. They don't enjoy security, peace. When I talk to the Palestinian people, either in outside Palestine or inside Palestine, the message is justice and peace. I think is we can't have peace without justice. This is a very important issue. And Palestinians is maybe the only party is very interested in peace because it will, I mean, make them live peacefully and do their own work, life, as other humans, you know, in the world. I think it's enough suffering for the Palestinian people. How many people should be die until we have our own self-determination. Until the present, you know, we lost a lot of humans. And I think it's time now for the international community to provide us with hope.
That's Izzat Salah Abdul Hadi, the head of the General Delegation for Palestine to New Zealand. You can find all of our interviews on YouTube. Just search NZ Q&A, and we've got a playlist there with interviews which relate to the Israel-Hamas conflict. After the break, we're talking AUKUS with a world-leading expert who explains what he thinks New Zealand will miss out on if we don't join the Security Pact. Welcome back. As well as laying into Australia's former foreign minister, Winston Peters has laid out his thinking on the controversial AUKUS security pact. And while he insists New Zealand hasn't made a firm call either way about joining AUKUS Pillar 2, voices on both sides of the debate are pushing their respective cases. Among those extolling the benefits of AUKUS, Professor Michael Green. He's the CEO of the US Studies Centre in Sydney and previously served as a special assistant to US President George W. Bush.
Well, on the one hand, it's a very significant agreement. The U.S. And the U.K. are transferring our most advanced capabilities, our most advanced technology to Australia, nuclear propulsion for submarines, something that the U.S. has only done once before in 1957 to the Royal Navy, and that the U.S. probably would not have done even 5 years ago. But the nature of the challenge, the nature of the security environment's deterioration is so significant that the U.S. has passed legislation, put in the budget, significant budget, as have Australia and the U.K., for that. So in that sense, very significant. On the other hand, it's not a treaty. It's just an agreement to develop submarines together. And that's Pillar 1 of AUKUS. And in Pillar 2, to work on emerging technologies like quantum and cyber and hypersonics.
Why is the U.S. so keen to counter China's influence in the Pacific?
The U.S.-China relationship was not on a bad trajectory when I worked in the White House in the Bush administration. In 2005, President Bush sent me to meet with Hu Jintao, and I did meet with him, and I had a letter from the president saying, this is the year to bring U.S.-China relations to the next level. There were plenty of challenges, but the feeling was that we could manage them. That has changed significantly with Xi Jinping. And it's not just that the PLA, the Chinese military, is larger. It's that Xi is employing them in much more aggressive and risky ways, killing Indian troops in the Himalayas, massive bomber runs against Taiwan that never used to happen, very aggressive confrontations with the Philippines, with Japan. The PLA is large, and the big advantage that the U.S. has retained is undersea submarines. 15 years, 20 years lead over the PLA. And if you want to be sure that China doesn't do something foolish or risky, you want to be sure that you have continued dominance under the water where you can't be found, which is why Australia wanted Virginia-class U.S. submarines and why the U.S. agreed to transfer them. That's sort of the nexus of the AUKUS deal.
Let's talk about New Zealand's place in AUKUS. What have you made of the way the AUKUS Pillar 2 debate has played out in New Zealand so far?
Well, it is important to begin with the recognition that this is not a security treaty. It's not an ANZUS or a NATO. It's in particular, Pillar 2 is a technology sharing agreement. The Japanese Prime Minister Kishida was in Washington recently, and President Biden agreed, and Prime Minister Albanese agreed that Japan would now be the first country to participate in some way, to be determined, in that Pillar 2 technology sharing. And next in line would be potentially New Zealand, Canada, Korea. And it's an opportunity for those countries, including New Zealand, to open the door and get in the room to extremely advanced technology that's being developed in the US, in the UK, and to a lesser extent, but significantly in Australia. I went to Johns Hopkins University. The Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, which does work on physics and submarines and so forth, their annual budget is $2.4 billion U.S. This one laboratory at one U.S. university. So the opportunity for New Zealand, if it were to choose to join AUKUS in Pillar 2, would be to tap into that advanced technology. Probably New Zealand doesn't need hypersonic missiles, but quantum could be extremely important because quantum computing is about more than just conventional warfare. It's about security of infrastructure. It's about intelligence, processing and analyzing intelligence, a lot of things that would be useful, but it will also cost money. So that's a decision the New Zealand government will have to look at.
What would be the downsides to New Zealand in doing military?
There'd be a bit of homework for Australia and the UK and the US. There was a bit of legislation, a bit more work all the countries had to do to strengthen the protection of the technologies, which is not beyond the grasp of the government. There will be some diplomatic blowback from China. I saw the Chinese ambassador wrote a piece firing a bit of a warning shot at New Zealand on this one.
Some diplomatic blowback's probably an understatement, isn't it? It would be viewed as highly antagonistic from the Chinese perspective.
Well, the Beijing would want the debate in New Zealand to portray it as highly antagonistic. In Japan, in India, in the Philippines, in Korea, AUKUS is very welcomed, because those governments see the importance of maintaining stability, and stability requires not just engagement with Beijing, but also deterrence.
But none of those countries are dependent in the way that New Zealand is on China when it comes to trade.
Not in the same way, but they are dependent. I mean, New Zealand's exports to China are significantly higher than Australia or Japan, but those countries are quite dependent. And the Japanese approach, for example, is... as they increase defense spending and join AUKUS, their official policy is they seek a more productive relationship with China. So for a smaller country like New Zealand, the diplomatic question's a good one. It's one that should be debated. On the one hand, if the policy is don't do anything that antagonizes China, then you invite Beijing to put more demands on New Zealand.
I guess the question in New Zealand would be, why would we antagonize our biggest trading partner when they've explicitly warned that it would be an antagonizing move, when the benefit is that we get access to slightly better technology? How is that possibly a good deal?
Well, it would depend on the calculation about how valuable that technology is and how useful it is. As I said, I think in the quantum area, it could be quite significant and advantageous for New Zealand, because we're talking billions of dollars of investment in R&D in the US and UK and Australia that New Zealand now gets to get in line at lunch and partake as well if it were to join.
Do you accept, though, that as good as that technology is and as good as that access is and as valuable as it might be, ultimately a decision that would meaningfully harm our trade relationship with our biggest trading partner might not be worth it to New Zealand?
I think the question for any country that's dependent on the Chinese economy, which is basically every country to some level, is at what point do you stand up for your interests and your values? And that'll be a calculation that varies by country. But I would assume for New Zealand that there's no support for giving Beijing a blank check to do what it wants because of economic interdependence. And so the decision then is, does New Zealand let Beijing deter moves that enhance New Zealand's own capability? And it's a judgment call. I don't think that the U.S. or Australia or the U.K. is pushing New Zealand to do this. I don't think that U.S. or Australia or U.K. relations with New Zealand would suffer if New Zealand didn't.
Wouldn't suffer at all?
I don't think so. I mean, the U.S.-New Zealand relationship has evolved so much since I was in the White House in areas like space launch. Very significant. And so I don't think it's look, I don't think the U.S. government is pushing Wellington hard to do this. And look, the way things are going, the tension with China is not a U.S.-China tension. It's a region-wide problem. In Tokyo, in Canberra, in Delhi, people worry about a PLA, a Chinese military strategy, to develop military capabilities across the whole region, including the Pacific Islands. So that's not nothing. That is something that has to come into the calculation, I think, for Wellington.
You mentioned your time in the Bush administration. Of course, during that period, you worked alongside New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark. When we think about the foreign policy decisions she made, Iraq stands out in her decision not to send New Zealand troops to Iraq. Of course, she is now vocal in her criticism of New Zealand's potential admission to AUKUS Pillar 2. She says it would be destabilizing and antagonistic for our biggest trading partner. Why should we join AUKUS Pillar 2 when Helen Clark was right?
Well, I thought the interview was fascinating, and I was the senior official in the White House responsible for the Indo-Pacific, so I prepared President Bush for his meetings with Helen Clark, would often be there taking notes. He liked her, actually. She charmed him. They had fun. They teased each other. They're from different sides of the political spectrum, but they had good banter. Support from New Zealand after 9/11 was quite moving, actually. I remember a Kiwi author, a cookbook author, sent books to a bunch of us in the White House called Tucker for the Soul, which literally brought tears to people's eyes, the sort of outpouring of support after 9/11. New Zealand's SAS served in Afghanistan, the first time, really, that U.S. and New Zealand troops have been in combat together since, you know, the 1980s. Iraq turned that all very sour in New Zealand. I, at one point, thought that we would be able to move the U.S.-New Zealand relationship forward very rapidly and get past the mid-1980s. We hit two obstacles, to be honest. One was, in those days, we still, we were running out of conventional powered aircraft carriers. We only had nuclear powered carriers. Japan had never hosted a nuclear powered carrier. So in the early 2000s, we had to deploy a nuclear powered carrier in Japan. And the Japanese government and the Australian government were very sensitive about a la carte exceptions. That was a problem. But to be honest, the other problem was that Prime Minister Clark campaigned against President Bush on Iraq, and it got back to him, and the White House knew. Was she right? Look, I mean, in her interview, you asked her a good question, which is, China of 2024 the same China that signed the FTA with New Zealand? And it just isn't.
Was she right about Iraq, though?
That's a... did she talk about Iraq in your interview?
She didn't know. Okay. In her interview... When I say, was she right about Iraq, I mean, was she right about not sending New Zealand troops to Iraq?
Oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
See, a lot of conflict on that.
Yeah.
And I remember her warnings about Iraq.
Yeah.
And she is issuing similar, different, but in one sense, a similar level of alarm about Pillar 2 of AUKUS. And so my question is...
They're just... I mean, apples and oranges doesn't even do justice to how different those two things are.
It's aligning with the U.S., right?
Yeah, but it's aligning with the U.S. in the case of Iraq in the use of force. Combat. And in the case of AUKUS, it's a technology program. Mm. It's developing technologies. And in Pillar 2, they're dual-use technologies, primarily.
Both, in her view, would be destabilizing acts.
Destabilizing acts because China doesn't like them?
Well, invading Iraq has ultimately proved to be a hugely destabilizing event, that decision. But also, she would say that a decision to align with the U.S. under Pillar 2 is potentially destabilizing in the region. It would be an antagonistic move, in her view.
Helen Clark would say that. She comes from the left of labor. She has a worldview, which I respect but disagree with, that liberal institutions, liberal idealism, development, engagement, and trade will solve all. It didn't in 1912 when Norman Angell published his famous book predicting war would never happen because of economic interdependence. It didn't before World War II when the head of one of the biggest U.S. banks predicted there would never be a war between Japan and the U.S. because we were so economically interdependent. And there are many other examples. I think most of the world... And in the, at least certainly the fellow democracies, whether it's Japan or India or Germany, because of Ukraine, because of Chinese coercion, have decided in that balance between engagement, diplomacy, trade, and liberal idealism and old-fashioned deterrence and balance of power, we need to be paying a bit more attention to the balance of power, not to the exclusion of trade, development, and diplomacy, but... because you need a full toolkit.
Yeah.
So she's wrong about that. If this were a decision to confront China militarily, then yes, that would be a stark choice. But New Zealand already, for its defense forces, procures equipment from the U.S. and the U.K. New Zealand already has military forces. New Zealand, in Five Eyes, already cooperates with the U.S., U.K., and others on advanced cyber and other capabilities. What AUKUS Pillar 2 is about is, do you want to bring that up to the next level or not? It's not a departure. It's a new technology sharing agreement. So in that sense, I don't think it compares to Iraq at all.
That's Professor Mike Green. He was here to deliver this Howard Kippenberger lecture at Victoria University. And you can see our full interview on YouTube. Hei Akuene. Q&A is back after the break. Kua mutu, that is Q&A for this week. From the Q&A team, thank you for watching. Ngā mihi ki a koutou I ngā karere. Thanks for your feedback. Hei, te rā wiki. We'll see you next Sunday at 9 a.m. Q&A is made with the support of New Zealand On Air.